our moderator for tonight, Mark Lysette. Mark is the director of the Program on the Global Environment and the interim director at the Center for International Studies here at the university. Tonight, we will hear about sustainable development and the economic policy changes that must occur at home and abroad to enable this new economic model. Our speaker, Marie-Monique Robin, is an award-winning French documentary maker, writer, journalist, and activist. Though born in France, her work in freelance journalism has taken her to Central and South America, and her research for her documentaries has likewise led her abroad. In The World According to Monsanto, for which she received the Rachel Carson Prize, she showed the darker side to the food industry and exposed the detrimental conventions of agribusiness. In her most recent documentary, Good Old Growth, she advocates for local heroes and sustainable growth initiatives at home. She questions whether our continued growth is sustainable or even necessary, and how we can change our way of measuring economic success to promote a more ecologically conscious world. She sees the need for change. This is what we are here to talk about today. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Marie-Monique Robin.
L'Europe a besoin de projets. Elle a besoin de solidarité. Elle a besoin de croissance.
Economic growth means strength and vitality.
Wachstum erlaubt es, solide Finanzen zu schaffen.
La croissance qui nous manque, je veux aller la chercher. Je veux aller la chercher non à l'extérieur de nous-mêmes, mais en nous-mêmes.
Each of us must be an engine of growth.
La croissance, c'est pas un mythe. La croissance, il ne faut pas l'attendre, il faut la faire.
We need to invest in what will promote hiring and economic growth now.
On attend, on annonce encore d'ailleurs, pour le mois prochain, dans deux mois, dans six mois, un retour à la croissance.
Qui met du temps, hein?
Qui met du temps, voilà.
Mayor crecimiento económico.
For growth and jobs.
La crescita.
La crescita.
Wachstum.
C'est toujours bien, non?
Growth.
Croissance.
Growth.
The end of growth has already come. We will not see again anywhere, certainly not in the West, the kind of growth, physical growth in prosperity, in food production and so forth, which we saw, let's say, in the 80s and the 90s. Those days are just gone.
Growth will not return, for the main reason, as humorously explained by leading American economist Kenneth Boulding, that anyone who believes in infinite growth on a physically finite planet is either crazy or an economist.
Just as a rather bizarre and peculiar example, we ask the question, what would happen if a humble hamster didn't stop growing? A hamster doubles its weight each week up to the age of about 6 to 8 weeks. If it didn't stop at that point and kept on doubling, at 1 year old, you'd be looking at a 9 billion ton hamster that in a single day could eat global maize production for a year.
Especially for Western economies, growth is becoming much more difficult because of the convergence of three factors. One is more expensive oil. The second is increasing cost of environmental impacts from industrial processes, principally climate change. And the third is an over-reliance on debt, which has been used to stimulate growth for the past several decades.
I firmly believe that if you look around the world today and asked, for example, can we imagine a better financial system? Can we imagine a better energy system? Can we imagine a better food system? Can we imagine a better transport system? All around us, there are live and practical examples of ways to do things better. Our challenge is to bring them together and put them under the nose, thrust them under the noses of politicians and say, why not? It's there. Why don't we have something better? Because it's out there.
I studied politics.
I studied French.
I studied political science and geography.
I actually studied economics. Yeah.
And I practiced investment law, so I advised large hedge funds and private equity funds.
This is Denmark, and you can see Samsø is right in the center of Denmark. This is Europe,
with the new member states, and you see, Samsø is right in the center of Europe also. You probably didn't know that, but that's for sure. And this is the Earth. And my point here, apart from the joke, is to say that I think it's really important to understand that your responsibility is in where you live. In 1997, we won the competition to be the Danish energy island. We pledged to give up fossil fuels and convert to 100% renewable energy. We were successful, and it's a good thing that the project worked, that we proved that it was possible to make this change. So what is the problem? It is, of course, quite difficult to predict the future, but I think there's no doubt that oil and fossil fuel will be more expensive in the future because we are more people that need to share the same resources. This is the lifestyle of the Americans or the Western world. So you can see this is a big car and this is a big house and this is all the trips and travels and this is all the meat we eat and all the things that kind of all together makes us big consumers, heavy consumers. So to bring the donkey back on the ground again, this is maybe one of the exercises that you're doing here. How can we change this in a way so we get more self-supplied economy in the system we are working at now? Because this requires more oil all the time.
So if every person on Earth achieved the same material standard as Europeans enjoy today, we need three planets. If everyone achieved North American material standards, then just to support the present population, we'd need four planet Earths. Ecological overshoot has been around for several decades now. You know, the phenomenon of growth, economic growth, is really very recent. It's only about 150 or 200 years old where we've had a sustained period of growth. And actually, most of it has happened since the Second World War. And in sometime in the late 1960s to late 1970s, in that range, for the first time, we reached a state of overshoot where the total demand by the human system, by the human enterprise, exceeded the sustainable capacity of Earth to provide our needs and to assimilate the wastes produced by that consumption.
You know the phrase, think global and act local. I think that we should change that to think and act local. We need more local heroes. Local heroes has always been needed. Local leaders and people who will take on the responsibility to collect the people and organize structures and be the inspiration of the changes.
Innovations like urban agriculture, community energy, new forms of consumption, all of the innovations of what we call the new economy are not just economic, they are also processes which empower communities. It also makes communities much more resilient in the face of shocks that come from the outside.
Resilience is the ability to tolerate the interruption of a crucial flow, either a flow in or a flow out. So, draw an imaginary circle, put your family inside, and start to think about all the things that have to come in and go out to sustain the happiness of your family. Money, garbage, food, energy. Well, this thought experiment, which you can do for the family, you can do also for your community, for your factory, for your school, for your country. And in each case, you find useful things to do.
For me, one of the key concepts in transition is this idea of community resilience as economic development. Whether it's in terms of food, so we have a more resilient food system, whether we have an energy system which is more resilient, whether it's having a local economy that's really framed about resilience, all of those things we can really see as an opportunity for entrepreneurship and economic activity, creating a new economy that sits alongside and then replaces the old one.
Local and regional currencies have the advantage of being able to stabilize the economy, a smaller, more modest, and ecologically more sustainable economy, which is uncoupled from the great global flows of finances and resources.
Sovereign is he, not who has great wealth, but he who has few needs. It's a sentence by Nico Pech, but today we are moving towards sobriety. Nico? Over to you.
The person I'm going to describe to you lives in Traunstein in 2050 in a post-growth society. This person is a prosumer, no longer just a consumer. A prosumer works 20 hours a week and earns a little money. With this money, he can consume enough without stress and, above all, in a more sustainable way. He uses the 20 free hours that are now at his disposal to practice important activities. Firstly, being personally productive, for example, in his garden or making craft objects. Secondly, in the shared use of assets, like a car, a power drill, or a digital camera. And thirdly, in repairs, to prolong the use of equipment. All these are tricks to slow down industry, quietening it, without having to renounce its performance.
It is the challenge of the post-growth society. It is not by any means a dark, cold, dismal place with fewer opportunities. It is a place of enormous freedoms and enormous ability to be human beings. It can be materially light. It can be less greenhouse gas intensive, less energy intensive. It doesn't demand material goods because what you're providing is service, not stuff. And perhaps most important of all, it is inherently labor intensive. It is employment rich. It's a place where there is an almost unending demand for the services that people can provide for one another. It's a place where you can keep employment in your economy, deliver quality at the community level, and reduce the impact that we're having on the planet.
Let me welcome you to the University of Chicago and say how much I enjoyed the film, and to encourage everyone who has the film in its entirety to take the first opportunity you have to do so. Let me start by asking about growth. Right? Growth is a deliberately ambiguous and a very powerful idea, and it takes in a great deal from these purely formal or mathematical measures of national economic activity, of agricultural productivity, of demographic change, while simultaneously evoking notions of prosperity, of progress, of development that go well beyond a purely statistical or even economic realm. At the same time, growth is dangerous. It's potentially destructive. It's rapacious in its appetites, and it's amoral in its operation. Edward Abbey, the American writer and environmental activist, famously referred to growth for growth's sake as the ideology of the cancer cell. In this light, can you talk to us a little bit about the ways in which you see growth as a central problem of the 21st century and why you've chosen to make it the focus of your latest project?
Actually, it began because I made The World According to Monsanto, the documentary and the book, and made a lot of other documentaries about industrial agriculture. And I showed, the impact on environment, on farmers, on consumers, on the water, on the seeds, and so on. And the next question was if this agro-business system just come out of the blue, you know? It didn't come out of the blue. It's part of a larger system which is based on unlimited economic growth. And the problem with economic growth is that it's exponential. You saw the story with the hamster here at the beginning, but it could give another example, for instance, of, you know, the story of the lily on the pond, you know? We know that, exponential growth means that a volume, for instance, doubles each X year, for instance. If it's 1% growth in a year, you will have the volume doubling in 70 years. If it's 2% in more or less 35 years, if it's 3% more or less 24 years, and 10% in 7 years, okay? And the story with the lily is very interesting because the lily is doubling on the pond every day, okay? And we know that in 30 days, the lily will have covered all the pond, okay? Now my question is, when will the lily have doubled half of the pond? Questions?
I think I'm going to have nightmares about that hamster.
What? When? Which day?
Yeah.
What is the answer to my question? The lily will have doubled the half of the pound at the 29th day, okay? Yeah? Not at the 15th day, at the because it doubles every day. Now the question, this image is an image used by Dennis Meadows in his book, The Limits to Growth. And when you think about the Earth right now and the pond, okay, we are exactly at the 29th day, that's it. Mm-hmm. We are covering all the pond, yes. Mm-hmm. This is a problem with exponential growth because economic growth depends on material resources, and now we have really reached the limits of these resources. If you take fossil fuels, for instance, everything indicates that we have passed the famous peak oil, you know? That means that the demand will exceed the production of oil or gas. And if you take, for instance, ores and minerals, it's the same. There is only one ore bauxite with which you make aluminium, which is not depleted. But most of the minerals and ores are getting depleted also. If you think about biodiversity, we speak about the sixth mass extinction. This is a big issue, you know. We have really reached the limits. Resources are getting scarce, really. And we have also reached another limit, which is the capacity of the Earth of absorbing the wastes we are producing. Pollutions of every kind, or greenhouse gas emissions. This is a big waste we are producing. The Earth can't anymore absorb all these wastes. The question is how can we keep on promoting an economic system based on unlimited growth, knowing that the resources we need to produce this growth are getting depleted. This is very important question, and that, in the present economic system, nobody takes it into account. And this is the problem.
And given the finite nature of the planet, right, and the finite nature of all of the resources that you've talked about, why do you think it is that growth remains such a powerful image in political discourse, as the opening montage of the film shows us?
Because, you know, after the Second World War, all the institutions are based on growth. And it's true that it's like an addiction, you know. In the short term, it's like an addict. He needs more drug, and it's good for the short term. Yes, even he knows that the drug at the long term will kill him, you know. It's the same with growth. All the institutions are based on growth, and if you don't have growth, that means unemployment at the short term, you know. And it's very difficult for politicians to think in another way, because all the system is based on this growth principle. The problem is now, how do we build and rebuild the institutions to take into account all the limits we spoke about before, resources limit and waste limit and so on, and to prepare a future based on what I call a post-growth society, which is a new paradigm. Mm-hmm.
Whenever we conceive of the relationship between population and environment, between humans and our resource base, the image of a finite planet immediately comes to mind, right? And we've seen this discourse as it's carried out in the film. Of course, a central but often ignored term in this equation is consumption, right? Especially the consumption patterns of the affluent West or global North, right? Patterns that cannot be sustainable, right, if they're extended to the vast populations of the global South. The historian Ramchandra Guha has challenged us to consider the limits of affluence in his very provocative, very interesting 2006 book, How Much Should a Person Consume? How does your work engage the question of consumption, and especially the question of affluence and the limits to affluence?
Tim Jackson, who used to work for the British Commission for Sustainable Development. He wrote a very interesting book called Prosperity Without Growth. He says that consumption is really the engine of growth. That means we need to consume, you know, to nourish the beast. And the beast is really insatiable, you know. Really. The problem is that he says also that consumption is an cage, iron cage, where everyone is locked, you know. You, me, we are all locked in consumption because we need to consume. If we don't consume, we don't have the last iPhone. We are second-class citizens, you know. And consumption is everywhere. Therefore, last year, we spent $400 billion just for advertising. It's a huge quantity of money, you know. Films are also locked into this iron cage because they need all the time to new innovations, you know, new markets, and they have to, really. It's also very difficult for films, and governments also are locked into consumption. Therefore, also when we see the data from the last 10 years, we see how the debt of households really increased a lot everywhere, in the US or in France. For instance, we know that in France, consumption, household consumption, represents 57% of GDP, and in the United States, 67%. It's really very important. And therefore, people have debts, and the debts increase a lot. Now, your question with North and South. The problem is that we, in all countries where we really have a very big ecological debt, you know, you saw what William Rees said. If everyone on this planet would live like an European people, we would need 3 planets, and like an American people, 4 planets. We don't have 4 planets for sure. And now we have to stop here in all countries. The question is, how do we do that? But we have to stop also to free some ecological space for the South countries, where they need already to satisfy their basic needs. And it's a question of sharing. Mm. If we want to cope with the question of limits, we have to cope with the question of sharing. This is very difficult for many people to understand that, but it's the only solution, because if we don't, we will all lose. And we will all really go towards what I call, not only me, but the collapse, a global collapse. When you think about global warming, for instance, it's a big issue. And it's serious. And we have really to do something if we want to avoid a big ecological disaster and many suffering from people, climate refugees everywhere and so on, destruction. We know, for instance, I was yesterday at the United Nations, that in 2012 the costs due to climate disasters, hurricanes, droughts, floods, have increased dramatically the last years. In 2012, it was more than $120 billion just 1 year, just to the costs, you know, economic losses due to climate events. And if we don't stop this machine, it will be each day more and more expensive in terms of in economic terms and also human damages. Therefore, some countries in the southern area of the planet, they need more growth to reach a certain development. The problem is that they don't follow the same kind of development as we did. This is a problem.
Which we can't afford as a planet,
as
a species.
And then there is what the ecological economists call the convergence, where everyone is on this planet could have his basic needs satisfied, you know, and thrive, but without depleting the resources so that the next generation also can thrive. This is now what is at stake. And if we don't do that, it would be very difficult for mankind to survive, really. When you speak to all these experts, they tell you it would be very difficult to survive because we have become a sort of parasite. We are really eating our host. The Earth is a host, you know. We are eating the host from inside.
You know, I want to follow up on some of these ideas in just a moment. But one of the things I want to point out, particularly in talking, say, about the urban farming in Toronto, which we only saw a few seconds of in these clips, one of the things that's striking is the way in which people can understand their livelihoods, right, as being enriched by consuming less. Right? So it's not necessarily a stricture to the Western world to stop consuming so much, right? To put limits on yourself as a kind of punitive measure. But instead, it's an affirming, a socially affirming, a community affirming kind of process of coming to understand the relationship between your needs and your capacity to produce and your responsibilities to your community and to the larger world.
Yeah, urban agriculture is one part of my documentary. The documentary, actually, we saw a lot of experts in these pieces we just showed, but 80% is about alternatives to this growth society. And there are three pillars. One is urban agriculture, and then it's about energy transition, and then local currencies. All these movements are big social movements in the north and in the south, and the goal is to relocalize food production, food consumption, energy also, and money through local currencies. And it's so interesting. I was in Toronto, and this is a city where the municipality is supporting a very interesting program of urban agriculture. And in this case, I was with a cooperative where all are what career shifter, you know. It has been created by a lawyer who used to work at the stock exchange in New York and just left everything and began to grow organic food in Toronto. And it's very interesting because, really, these people, they are very worrying, really, about the future of what we said before, climate change and shortages in resources and so on. But they want to act here and now and build communities and initiatives which are already showing the way to another kind of society, more sustainable, where it's like you know what we call a care economy, where you really take care of the food, of people you are living with, and this is a big movement in the north and in the south.
And let's take the first question from the audience, please.
Hi, I'm Helen Kessler, and I want to thank you for your comments. You know, I agree with where you're coming from, and yet what I see happening in the world doesn't jive very well with where you're coming from. First of all, oil prices have gone down rather than up recently, and people are buying bigger cars, and people are driving more, and... How do we get the word out? I mean, where do we, you know, what are your thoughts about how we can change the society to have this local kind of thing going on? Because I certainly don't, I mean, you know, they're little pockets. They're pockets here in Chicago, but that's pretty little.
Yes, this is a question. How do we do? In the documentary, you can see how communities are doing, you know, together. And this the idea is we begin, you know, at the bottom. It is bottom up, you know. And we hope that we can convince politicians, you know, to make this systemic change we need if we want to avoid the collapse and big social problems and so on, and for sure ecological disaster. And the problem is that...
How do we do it fast enough?
I know.
You know, like, it's a great idea, but we're not getting to, you know, all those politicians up there are speaking about growth today. The most brilliant economists are all talking about growth. It's like, what?
Yeah.
And how do we change all that, like, really fast? Because I think your point about the doubling is really important, and most people don't understand that.
Yeah. It's because it's difficult to answer what it means, exponential growth. It's not linear, you know. It's doubles and doubles and doubles. Yeah, how do we do? We don't have any other option to gather and to build initiatives. Urban agriculture is a great movement. Local currency also, it was for me very interesting and quite new, actually. I thought when I began working on that it was just a gadget, you know, so, okay. But no, it's incredible how local currencies can really help people to begin to think about consumption, you know, and supporting local economy. And I was in Brazil and in Germany and following two local currencies, and it can achieve a very big impact and very quickly. And then it opens doors to other questions about energy, you know, about what kind of food do I eat, and so if it will be enough, I don't want to ask this question because, you know, we are very at a crossroads right now. We have to act very quickly, very quickly. And it's the first time in my life I've been doing this job for 30 years, you know, and when I began as a journalist, I wanted to change the world, but in 200 or 300 years, you know. I never thought that it would be so urgent, you know. And it is urgent. The problem is that... it's very difficult to move the politicians. First of all, because the political system is designed in a way that when you... The political parties became electoral machines, you know, just thinking about re-election, the politician also. And if you want to build this transition to a post-growth society, to a more sustainable society, you have to have a vision, really, and a long-term vision. And this is very difficult with the present political system. And the other problem is that there are vested interests, like Monsanto, this is one of the companies I must know, but many of them are in the same line. These vested interests, they want that the system keeps on going in the same way. They really, and they are very close to the politicians. And this is a big problem. And maybe you heard about recently the NGO, the British NGO Oxfam, who presented a report which said that nowadays less than 100% in the world owns as much as 3,500,000,000, and that 1% of the richest on this planet owns 50% of the world assets. This is our data. I mean, this is a problem. And when you, I read the book Collapse. By Jared Diamond.
And right. Yeah.
Yes, it was very interesting because when you really try to understand why previous societies, you are an anthropologist, but why they collapsed, there are three factors in common And one is the fact that they didn't take into account the limits of the resources and just depleted the resources. The second is that they had a climate problem, for instance, a drought for the Maya civilization, drought which lasted several years or two decades. And the third factor is that the elite is completely in its bubble, you know, and in very selfish, very it's exactly what we have now. The three factors are exactly the same as for the Easter Island, for instance. And now, how do we do to come back to your question? My answer is what they are doing, these guys, in my documentary. You know, local initiatives. Begin where you are. You know, and try to relocalize food production and energy and so. And we don't have any more option. Hoping that you can also, because what I show in my documentary, these initiatives work better when the local authorities are involved also. And I think really traveling a lot that local authorities are more alike to support this kind of initiatives. Cities, for instance, can have a very big impact in these initiatives. You have to speak with your local authorities, you know, and try to get more gardens, you know, community gardens, cooperatives, you know, farmers markets, and so on.
I just want to follow up that question with a question about governance, a more general kind of question about governance, which I think is a really kind of key issue that's discussed in the film, and only touched on really in some of the clips that we saw. But community management of important resources, of local currency markets, of urban gardens, and even this important idea in Bhutan of gross national happiness are all crucially dependent on structures of governance that support their goals, that provide structures for their implementation and their regulation, and that evince a willingness to devolve power to the local level. So how do we build models of governance that promote sovereignty, resource sovereignty, that promote local solutions, and that promote the emergence of the local heroes that we heard about?
Yes, local heroes. we need a new kind of democracy. This is a problem, you know. And in Bhutan, Bhutan was for me really a very special experience. I spent 3 weeks there, and sometimes I really thought I was dreaming, you know. And then, for those who don't know, Bhutan has implemented a new wealth indicator, which is supposed to replace GDP, yeah? And it's called gross national happiness. You are smiling. Yes, that's fine. Yeah. And it's so interesting because it's changed all the politics of the country, for sure. Because they decided, for instance, according to this new index, that the country would be 100% organic in 2020. And they decided to send back to Switzerland all the pesticides and chemicals they used to be destroyed there in Switzerland, and they did that. They decided not to enter the World Trade Organization, because they said if we do that, we have, for instance, very good organic cotton, you know, with people doing very nice, you know, clauses with this organic cotton, and so if we enter the World Trade Organization, we will be, you know, invaded with you know, cotton or synthetic cotton from India and so on, they decided not to enter the
DT cotton.
Yeah, exactly. And they changed the program in the schools. Now in the school, you keep on studying English, mathematics, and so on, but half of the time you learn how to garden organic, how to repair, to recycle, etc. Very, very interesting. And the question was, when I was there, why in Bhutan? Because it's really quite incredible. Why in Bhutan? Bhutan is a country where there is a king, and the king is not elected. In this case, he's a brilliant king, and he has a long-term vision for his people. And I don't want to say that we have to go back, you know, with that way. But it is very interesting because the problem, we said it before, politicians in the United States, like in France, they just think about how to get re-elected, and it doesn't help to take measures, you know, with the vision we need. And therefore, in the documentary, we see how people are really in the field of energy, for instance, through cooperatives and so, trying to develop what I would call a sort of democracy in energy, for instance. And it's the same for food, where people decide really together what kind of food do we want, how do we do that, and so on. And this is a way to the future, towards the future. You have a question?
Hi, thank you so much for coming. And so I was wondering what you feel like your role as a filmmaker and kind of spreading kind of awareness about like what other people are doing and what the options are, kind of what your role as a filmmaker you feel has been.
If it's the role of the filmmaker, I didn't understand the question.
I was wondering what you feel that your role as a documentary maker has been in helping kind of spread awareness and kind of,
I think this is a really important question, right? Yeah. Because what's your impact, right? As a practitioner, as an educator, as an artist, what do you feel that your impact is?
It's difficult to measure it, but I know that most of my documents are used as tools, you know, to educate people, to have debate and so on. And sometimes they had big impact. I will give you an example. When I was in Toronto, in this cooperative with these career shifters, you know, they were all before working for the stock exchange, very educated, and just decided to, you know, to change their life and to produce food in the city. And I met there a very young. He was very young, younger than this career shifter, and he was working on the farm, and I interviewed him. I told you before, it was very incredible, because I began filming him. Oh, why are you here? And he said, 2 years ago, I was, he said, a lost boy, and drug addict, and I felt very bad and didn't want to do anything, and I saw a documentary which changed my life. I said, what kind of document did you see? And he said, The World According to Monsanto. And I was filming, you can imagine. I went, and he asked, I did a documentary. This kind of thing happens with documentaries sometimes. But more generally, this documentary has big impact in France right now and in Europe, especially in France, because we have at the end of the year a very big climate conference in Paris, and I hope that it will be a success. It's not sure. And people are using the documentary to speak about that, to begin, what can we do, how do we do that, and so on. Because all these initiatives are a way of reducing, for sure, greenhouse gas emissions. It's one of them. Because if you produce food locally, you use less gas, less fuel, and so on. The same with energy, for sure. And the documentary is a tool for that. And it's the reason why I'm doing this job. Yes.
Let me ask one more critical question before we sort of move on into some of the more substantive issues in the film. A critic might point to Bhutan or to Toronto or to Fortaleza and say, well, you know, this experiment seems very successful and it's in its own little community setting, but why should we believe that this would work on a larger scale? Or if we put it in a different kind of social or political context? So to borrow a term that my colleagues in energy use, upscaling, right? What are the challenges in upscaling or extending the application of local solutions to sustainability, equity, and resource sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need change at both levels. We need change at the personal level. We need people who walk more, you know, eat differently, consume local food, and share with their neighbors, and so on. But we also need a change at the government level. That means that we, for instance, we should have laws, if you want to scale up and out all these initiatives we see in the documentary, we should have laws who really reward the firms which are respecting the environment, you know, not destroying the environment. And we should sanction the firms who are the wrongdoers, you know. And we should have the right incentives for the people and the firms who are doing the right thing. We should, for instance, consider that plant obsolescence is a crime, you know, when you design a machine or a wash machine, you know, to be out after 10 years because you have, what we call an ecocide. Ecocide is a crime against the environment. Yeah, we need change at the government level if you want to have the systemic change we need. If we don't have this support from government, it will be very difficult because we don't have time at both levels.
Now, one of the things that we didn't get to see much of in the clips is the discussion of these local currency markets, right? I mean, these are really fascinating kinds of things. Could you talk a little bit about how those work and how those might have broader applications?
Yeah, I was in Brazil where it's very interesting. It was a slum in Fortaleza, and a man called Joaquim Melio decided to create the first community bank in Brazil and the first local currency. And this local currency is called Palmas. It works. The community prints its local currency called Palmas, and it's one Palmas for one real. The real is a national currency. It's limited. The territory is limited in the community, which is called Palmeiras. This slum, this former slum, because thanks to the Palmas, really, it changed completely the community and all the village there. And this currency is used only in this territory. And that means that really it's connected to the real economy. And when you use it, for instance, you go and you buy your bread here, and then it's really turning in the community. And after 15 years, they just noted that in 1997, 80% of the people were consuming outside because there was nothing inside the community. Now it's quite the contrary. 15 years afterwards, More than 97 people are consuming inside the community because there are many jobs which have been created, you know. And little firms also, and it has really boosted all the local economy. And I could see the same in another country, so Germany. It's quite the opposite, very rich part in Bavaria. It's a very rich part of Germany. They are also local currency, and it's the same results. That means that it encourages local activities and makes the economy much more resilient, because if the big financial system breaks down, they can keep on, you know, producing food, consuming food, working, and so on. And this is actually, in this moment, there are more or less 5,000 local currencies in the world. 5,000?
5,000.
Yes, now. When I was doing the document, it was 3,000, now it's 5,000. Just in France, we've got 52 local currencies now. It's a big, big movement. In the US also, you've got time banks or here in the US. Very interesting movement. And the other very important thing is that all these local currencies, which are linked to a territory, they prohibit interest. You can't...
Right, and this is really crucial, right? Yeah. They're designed to resist investment and speculation and accumulation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to spend it, or it's not worth anything. Or in the case of the German currency, it declines in value if you don't spend it within a particular amount of time.
Yeah.
That's one key feature. Another key feature is that they're linked to the national currencies. So you can, you know, if you end up with a pile of them, you can actually do something with it. You're not stuck with this.
Yeah.
At the end, right?
Yeah. But there are these local currencies are complementary to the national currencies. The goal is not, you know, to replace the dollar or the euro and take, you know, it's really, we call them complementary currencies because they are playing a role which is really to satisfy real needs, you know, and to go out all these speculative system, which is one part of the problem we have right now, which is leading us toward a social disaster and financial disaster, you know. And I think it's a very important tool, a local currency, if you want to begin with an initiative towards post-core society. It's one of the most powerful tools.
And it does some really interesting things, right? It forces production and consumption to be local. And for a kind of investment, but not an investment to gain interest, but an investment in the community. Mm-hmm. Another kind of property of these systems that I found fascinating is that they allow for a kind of low interest or no interest loan system. Effectively a microcredit system that's also organized by these local banks.
Yeah, with zero interest.
Right.
Yes. And that means that you are not forced, you know, to work more, you know, because when you have a loan, you know, you have to pay much more because there is an interest rate which is linked to the loan you got in the bank. And this is part of the growth system. Because most of the money which is created right now, 95% actually, is through loans that the consumers get from the banks. It's really, and it's exponential also, you know, because with the compound interest, it's like growth, economic growth. It's really exponential. And local currencies have all in common that they prohibit interest, and you can have a loan, but with no interest, and you may not spare also with interest. Yes, it's when you to go back to the function of money, which is just exchanging, you know, and not make money.
So, how important do you expect these kinds of local currency systems to be over the next, say, 50 years, over the next 100 years?
If the trend is going on, as we are seeing it right now in the documentary, I was in the Netherlands where there was a big meeting, international meeting with economists involved in local currencies and practitioner people from the local communities coming with... I think we will have a lot of local currency everywhere. And it really began after the big subprime crisis and, you know, the recession afterwards. And there was really a link because these communities understood that they have to become more resilient. Resilient means also to be able to resist crisis. And once more, local currency is a means to develop this kind of resilience of capability of resist crisis.
I want to sort of touch on the ways in which this film might link up with some of your earlier work, and particularly with the World According to Monsanto. Food sovereignty, right, is a term that comes up over and over again throughout the world, and it's an important concern, not just to people who are interested in issues of sustainability and equity and farming, but also to the subjects of the film itself, right? They say it over and over, right? It's also an important concern of local and organic food movements, of community gardeners, of social and environmental advocates on a kind of worldwide basis, right? At the same time, there are many people concerned with food security issues, economists that I know, for example, who would argue that the needs of a growing world really can only be met through the continued application of industrial methods of agricultural production. Right? So how do you see that relationship between food sovereignty and food security? And what role do local and urban farmers have to play in this story?
I made a documentary and wrote a book called Crops of the Future. It was really to answer this question, could we feed the world without pesticides or chemical fertilizers? And because you know Monsanto, for instance, in its website say that okay, maybe there are some problems with pesticides, but without pesticides we couldn't feed the world. They forget to say that we don't feed the world, neither with pesticides. There are almost 1 billion people suffering from malnutrition or hunger, and most of them are small farmers, 80%. And my conclusion when I was doing, I spent 2 years working on this issue and work together with Olivier de Schutter, who used to be the UN rapporteur, special rapporteur for the right to food. And he made a report on agroecology as a means to feed the world. Agroecology means organic farming. It's a little more complicated, but I mean, without chemical inputs, which are based on gas and fuels, and only... looking for the interaction between plants and animals and trees. Also, agroforestry is a part of this agroecological system. And this is very important because we what we don't know most of the time is that almost 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions come from this industrial agricultural model. If you take all into account, for instance, these are the United Nations data, what I'm saying right now. 40% just for the fact that the industrial model use a lot of pesticides made with gas or fertilizers with fuel and a lot of irrigation and mechanization. And all this is 40%. And if you add 19% due to livestock, 90%. And 90% due to deforestation or the change in the use of land, as I say. That means deforestation to have monoculture, GMOs, for instance, in Argentina, as I saw it, deforestation to do biofuels and so on. Almost 50%. This is incredible. I mean, because normally agriculture should be a field where you capture carbon through photosynthesis, mm-hmm. for instance. It is quite the contrary. They are producing a lot of carbon. And then after 2 years, I was in Africa, I was in Japan, in Europe, in South America, everywhere, and the US also. The conclusion was we could better feed the world without pesticides, for sure. And it would be better for the planet also, less green gas emissions, for sure. We could better manage the water resources. You see here in the U.S., a big problem with water resources, and especially in the Midwest, where they are taking a lot of water for irrigation and for the corn and so on. And really, if you want to feed the world, we have to change also the paradigm. And there is a very interesting report published in 2008 called Agriculture at the Crossroad. It was part of the World Bank and the United Nations who asked for this report, and they really said exactly what I'm saying, that we have to change the paradigm, and we would be much more able to feed the world if we would give up pesticides and fertilizers. It's really a big lie when they are saying that without pesticides we couldn't feed the world. It's quite the contrary. Of course, that means organic farming for farmers in the countryside and also in the cities. And urban agriculture is part of that that model. But agroecology works only also if we change the way we are distributing food. The problem right now with the present system is that food items are traveling a lot. If you take what we call the food miles, you know. On average, we estimate, for instance, in North America, that a food item traveled about 4,000 kilometers between the producer field and the dinner plate of the consumer. In Europe, it's about 3,000 kilometers. It's incredible, you know. In all the way from the farmer's field and then to the processors and then to the supermarket and so on. That means we have become very dependent on oil just to feed ourselves, you know. And this is a very big vulnerability. And it's also, we calculated that every city right now has about 3 days of food on their shelves. That means that if there is a problem with gas or fuel, cities don't have anything to eat. We have to change the paradigms for that reason also. And urban agriculture is a way of solving this problem and of making us less reliant on petroleum to feed ourselves in the cities. It's part of the change. Many people have understood that. And I know that in Chicago, for instance, there is a very interesting organization called the Growing Power, mm-hmm. As in Milwaukee, I visited them when I was preparing my documentary. They're doing a great job in education also, because it's also part, the problem is also education, you know. And urban agriculture is part of this change of paradigm.
Hmm. So do you have a sense of how much of the food supply for any city, urban agriculture or local agriculture is able to supply?
There are studies showing, in Toronto, for instance, they made one, and I interviewed the author, he's in the documentary. They said that they could, with just 1% of the Toronto surface, including some, there are tops of the buildings and so on, you know, they could cover 30 to 60% of the needs of the city, just in vegetables, fruits, and poultry. For sure, you won't have many cows in a city, for instance, or cereals, wheat, and corn, not possible. But for vegetables, fruits, and poultry, it could be 30 to 60%. And there are other studies in the US which are showing the same. It's important. It could be very important. I mean, but you will need farms. It's not, I mean, for sure. But it's not nothing. It can be something important.
There are a couple of follow-up questions. One of the critiques of exactly this kind of urban farming and local farming is that the produce is too expensive for many people to afford. Is that something you've found to be the case?
The problem with the current system is that the prices of the food items are completely fake. Because when a big farmer here in the Midwest, for instance, is growing GMOs, transgenic corn, the price which is given is has nothing to do with the reality of, for instance, the pollution he is causing. He doesn't pay for the decontamination of the water.
So the full ecological cost isn't being figured in.
And the current system, we call this ecological cost externalities, you know. They are not taken into account in the price which is set up, you know, for the food item. And this is really a problem. If we want to change this, that means we should reward the farmers who are not contaminating the environment or the water and or the air and so on. And on the contrary, the wrongdoer should pay a tax for that, you know. But in the current system, we just give subsidies to the wrongdoers, and they go on for sure, because they don't have any. I mean, the system is done to encourage wrongdoers, and the externalities are not internalized, and we have to do that now if you want to change the paradigm. Therefore, the price that is paid in the supermarkets for the food items is absolutely has nothing to do with the reality of the costs, environmental costs, for instance, and so on. And this is another problem. This is also the reason why there are so many food wastes everywhere. 30% of the food is just thrown away, you know. This is a big disaster when you think about that. Therefore, the solution is also to encourage short chains of distribution, food distribution, you know. A good example is the so-called CSA, community-supported agriculture, where you have a direct relation between a producer and a group of consumers, you know. Mm-hmm. And with the basket every week,
right.
You know that.
I think many people here are probably familiar with CSAs.
Everybody knows what a CSA is. It's just really a model for the future, you know, to encourage this kind of food distribution. And this is also a movement everywhere, in France, also in Japan. When I make my documentary, Crops of the Future, I was in Japan, where actually the first CSA were created. And this is a big movement. We have to encourage that. And if you do that, normally the price of your organic food is not so high. Hmm. It's not so high as, for instance, organic food bought in a supermarket, for sure.
I have one more kind of question about the about food and urban agriculture. Are you familiar with the term food desert?
Yeah,
This idea of areas that are poorly served by the availability of fresh food through either markets or other means. What role do you see urban gardens, local gardens, organic produce playing in alleviating the very real food desert problem that we have in cities like Chicago?
Mm. Yeah, I saw it in Milwaukee with the Growing Power. It was really, where they are established as a food desert, really. And this is very typical for North America. In Europe, we don't have so much food desert. I mean, but this is a big challenge. Therefore, what the Growing Power is doing in Milwaukee is very interesting, because they are really trying to
to put an end to this food desert and encouraging local production, organic production with community gardens and so self-sufficient in also for in energy. I saw some, for example, that they had greenhouses and with and using biogas, you know, in the winter, because it can be very cold, like here in Chicago, but keeping on producing thanks to the biogas and in the greenhouses, very interesting. And this is a big issue because finally it's also an answer to a big problem which I see here, also in Europe, but you know, junk food, which is causing a lot of health problems, you know, which is good also with urban agriculture, is that it allows people to know each other. It's more links, you know, with neighbors and more links with the people living around you. It's good for health. Really, urban agriculture has many advantages. In Toronto, they have the municipality created what they call the Food Toronto Policy Council, and encouraging really urban agriculture for all these reasons as a way for fighting against obesity, diabetes, because it's also linked to junk food, you know, and also the quality of life. It's also a way of what they call mitigating climate change. If you have a big flood in the city, it's much better to have a lot of gardens, you know, for these floods and so on.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm really sold on everything you're saying, but getting back to the opposite of localization, you know, back when everyone was pushing globalization, we were kind of sold on two benefits. You know, we'd get things coming a lot cheaper because there'd be all these global efficiencies, but we'd also interlink economies in such a way that we'd be reducing the possibility of war. You know, why would you go to war against somebody you can depend on economically? Let's say that this movement of localization becomes more and more successful. We get more and more individually economically self-sufficient place. Do you worry that you could be a victim of the success, and all of a sudden one local community could go to war against another one that doesn't? What becomes the cohesion if in this model between the various relatively independent local economies?
When these communities are doing these initiatives, they are also connected with their, the other communities. It's not, you know, they're all connected and they're all aiming the same. I mean, how can we keep on living on this earth without jeopardizing the future of the next generations? And therefore, there is no competition. Competition belongs to the global world, actually. And you say that, okay, we are getting things very cheap, but as I said before, cheap, if you don't take into account, for instance, when you are buying a blue jean coming from China, for instance, it's $20. But if you really take into account what it really costs to the planet, I studied the question of the blue jean, of the jean. It's about, it's the same as driving 65,000 kilometers by car in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. The quantity of fuel you are using for this jean, you know, first the cotton comes from India and then it goes to China and then we'll send to Turkey for, you know, 65,000 kilometers. I mean, the current system is really blind in terms of what it costs to the planet or in terms of resources it uses. It's really blind. Mm. And now we are really at the crossroads in the sense that we really reach the limits. 30 years ago, we thought we would have time, and when Dennis Meadows, the economist who wrote this famous report, The Limits to Growth, in 72, at that time everybody thought, oh my God, we have time. No, now we don't have time anymore. That is the point. And really we have to change the paradigm. And if you want to take care, this is the new paradigm, is a care economy. If you want to take care, you do it better when you are taking care of your environment, where you live, you know, of the food you eat and you produce, you know. And if every community does that, connected for sure, then we have a big change, you know. And I think it's a way for the future, for sure.
So on that optimistic note, I'd like to thank
you very
much.
Optimistic, I don't know, but...
I'd like to thank you very much.
We have to be realistic and not... Yeah.
But thank you very much for joining us tonight. I'd like to ask everyone to join me in thanking you.